there is so much more to a conversation than just the words that are said. And that's one of the skills that we learn when we grow up in a particular culture, and it's also one of the things that is different in a different culture. You may have your own impressions of the way people from different parts of the country hold conversations. I think one of the examples that most North Americans would immediately recognize is New Yorkers as opposed to everybody else. Right? You assume that in a normal conversation, one person talks, another one stops, and another one takes up the conversation. But in New York, it's very common to have two people talking at once.
You know, like, have to get it done and go for something else.
That's right. And
it's not a family sometimes, too.
And that's another point, that within the context of a family, there may be slightly different rules of conversation. Now, we talked yesterday a bit about language and some general things about language. And, of course, one thing about language as... let's just talk about the language itself. Let's say the grammar. You know, it's a system of rules. Very simple kinds of rules, like you put the subject before the verb, or when you make something plural, you put the S on the end of the word. And, you know, other languages might have different rules. They might put their plurals at the beginning of the word or have the verb all the way at the end of the sentence or something like that. So what you do when you learn a language is you learn the system of rules. Well, on top of that, of course, there are lots of other rules. We live by rules of all kinds, and there are rules of conversation, how you have a conversation. And people have different rules in different places. To make things worse, of course, the rules are always changing on us depending on the situation. So there are basically two main problems in a conversation, and that's your belief about what is going on here. You know, what sort of conversation am I engaged in? What do I believe is true about this situation? And what we call in linguistics the context. Now, the context we could describe maybe as the set of assumptions you have, right? For example, sitting here in this sort of classroom setting, we have a different set of assumptions than we would if we were just sitting in the dining hall over cups of coffee. One of your assumptions is that I will do more talking than you do. You know, and think of the classroom where there may be one or two of the class members who have suspended that assumption and are doing more talking than the teacher. What does the teacher do? Calls their attention to the fact that they are violating one of the cherished assumptions of the teacher. So, today we're going to look at conversations and how they function in terms of all of these different components, the assumptions, the language itself, some of the beliefs of the participants, and so forth. Now let's start with the basics. And of course, when you're talking about some sentence, and I think I used the sentence yesterday, Wes Priebe as Holden's pool hall director, we can refer to what is being meant by that as a kind of proposition. Right? Propositions have a number of characteristics. One of them is they can either be true or false if they're statements. All right. So either Wes Priebe is the Holden's pool hall director or he isn't. Right. So we have on a very literal level, there is some bit of information that's being asserted. Right. And it could be up for debate or whatever, maybe true or false. That's at the very basic level, that's the sort of linguistic message that's coming out. All right? So we can think in terms of, on the one hand, there being a message. Now, I've used a statement there, but of course in English class at school, we learned there are different kinds of sentences. There are statements like that. What other kinds of sentences are there?
Questions,
right? We have ask lots of questions. Questions aren't true or false, but they have answers. Basically, there are two kinds. There are yes-no questions, which you can answer either yes or no. Lawyers love those, of course. That's what they use when they interrogate people in the courtroom. And then there are information questions where it's sort of fill in the blank. You know, what time is it? And then you have to fill in the blank that the what word said. So there are questions. And what other kinds of sentences do we have? Well, there are exclamations, and in the same category, I guess there are kind of vague things that we could call exhortations. They're not directed at anybody in particular, right? They just sort of let them out in the air. There actually are kinds of questions like that, too, rhetorical questions. What am I going to do today? You know, it's just not directed at anybody in particular, and it's just a question uttered out loud, and you don't really expect an answer, but then someone will come along and answer it anyway. You know? we could put one category there. Those are fairly frequent when you look at conversations. We say those, but they really, if you think about it, they don't have much to do with messages. They are not, in the sense that they're not directed to an audience in particular. Sort of directed to a general audience. And sometimes they're even for your own benefit. Oh dear. Oh, what a beautiful morning. It's just something you felt like having come out. But unlike a statement where you're trying to assert something or a question where you're trying to get some information, you don't have any very specific goal in mind in saying them. But then, of course, there's the other one.
I would say it's the type that invites discussion.
This? Yes.
The next phrase would be one that invites discussion. Not just a bold statement, not a direct question, but a subject that has to be discussed.
For example?
Oh, any problem that's risen, instead of just making a statement, we shall do this, or will you do this for me? A situation where you'll discuss it and come to a conclusion.
Well, but usually, those kind of, see, these things have a particular form, right? And we recognize that when we write them, because we put a period at the end of these, question mark at the end of those, and then we got one more punctuation mark we have. Well, these have exclamation points, some of them, right? But there's one that has a particular goal in mind, that's to get somebody to do something. Commands. Yeah. Now it's interesting that there are lots of assumptions. We're talking about context. There are lots of assumptions behind each of these different categories here. And in particular, you have to watch your assumptions. Like, you don't necessarily have the right to give just anybody commands. So, if you look at the form of these things, questions, statements, commands, and actually most of these exclamations or exhortations or something usually come in the form of one of the others, even though they're different from those because they don't have a specific goal in mind. If you look, we get these mixed up because of our differing assumptions. For example, if I said, would you mind opening the window? What am I trying to do? I'm not asking a question yes or no, right? It's actually what it is, it's a polite command.
Yeah, but children don't understand. I mean, they don't understand the polite command. They actually think they're being given a choice.
Yes, right. That's right. And why?
You're saying it would be inappropriate for me to command you, my teacher, to open the window. Uh-huh. So I might say, would you mind opening the window?
Yeah, that's right.
But you wouldn't say that to a child, because he'd say, oh.
Well, there are different assumptions there, right? Within the family, there is a greater degree of intimacy, and in intimacy, commands are all right, right? Take a look, for example, at the Lord's Prayer. It's full of commands. It, you know, give us this day our daily bread. We're telling God to do this? But that is really, when you look at the assumptions, that's a sign of intimacy. You know, we don't stand on ceremony here, we can just tell each other what to do. So that's one aspect in which we use those assumptions that make up the context of something to decide exactly how to phrase something. And part of our skill, social skill, is knowing when to do what, and who we can boss around with a command, and who we have to use a polite question with, and so forth. And so people are seen as rude if they don't understand these rules. So that's part of the whole business of belief and context, you know, that what you believe about a situation, you know, what's going on here, who are these people I'm talking to, and what is my status as opposed to theirs, and so forth, right? And one of the things that people try to do in organizations is establish kind of standing rules for context. The military is the classic example. You know, who can command who issues the orders, and who takes them, and their formulas for how to address people. And some societies, you know, have very elaborately formulated rules for all of this. Even in some languages, there are systems of what we call honorifics, where there are different degrees of honor that you must express with each sentence depending on who it is you're addressing. If you use the wrong one at the wrong time, you know, it's extremely bad, and you're going to have to hang your head in shame and bow and scrape and make all kinds of apologies because you used the wrong address to speak to someone. And I know I taught at the University of Vienna, and it's a very old university, and it was still very old in the sort of way, the customs of the university. I mean, I actually went by the professor's lounge one day and heard two professors standing outside having a conversation in Latin. I went back a second time because I couldn't quite believe my ears, but sure enough, it was Latin. And I was always in fear of running into either the dean or the rector because they had these extremely long forms of address in Latin. One was magnificens. The rector was a magnificence, you know. And it was really bad form if you didn't address him as Herr Magnificens, and, you know. And the dean was spectabilis. So, which is roughly translated as spectacular, you know. This is Vienna. It was still the old norms of the medieval university, you know, that this is the way things worked. And when the faculty got memos from the administration, the form of address was, "O thou well born." This was in the 1970s, you know. You still had to pass a big Latin exam to get a degree from this university. So in some societies, you know, these formulas are held on to for a long, long time.
You wouldn't get your degree unless you followed those.
Well, you at least had to pass your Latin exam. You had to know these things. Universities, you know, may be some of the most conservative organizations on earth, so it's not surprising that you find this. My son is studying in England this year, and he got a library card from the Bodleian Library at Oxford, and he said, "You wouldn't believe the oath I had to swear to get this card." It said, I will not sword fight in the galleries. kindle fires in the building? And so forth. And, you know, I said, why do you have this elaborate old... So, well, we've been doing it for 400 years. And that's just the way things are. And the point is, you have to learn these systems when you become part of them. Or, you know, you're in for all kinds of trouble. So, we have a proposition then, which is, if you want, the message itself. Taking our statement, it's just something you want to say. It might be true or false. And it's a way of conveying information. Now, propositions, unless they're written and you look at it and try to sort of leave out all of your assumptions and stuff, you rarely get the bare proposition. What happens is propositions come in wrappers. That's a term we like to use. They come with all this excess baggage that comes out of the context that it's spoken in. And so, for example, a question is sometimes not a question. It's a command. Mm-hmm. You know, if you looked at just the form of the sentence, would you mind opening the window, you'd say, well, that's a yes-no question. But the wrapper says something else. The wrapper says, this may look like a question, but it's not a question. Yeah. Well, there are lots of things that come into the wrapper, and tone of voice is one of them. Intonation. There are lots of statements which are questions. You're going uptown? Comes in the form of a statement, but it's really, the wrapper says, this is a question. I had a roommate in college who was from the mining towns around Pittsburgh in western Pennsylvania. And there is, in the English of that area, a very disconcerting thing, and that's that they have question and statement intonation backwards. Their statements go uphill, and I kept thinking, he's asking me another question. You know, it's something like, I'm going downtown? You know, and that's an assertion. But it never failed to throw me because the wrappers were reversed. So another word that we use for wrappers is something like meta message. It's a message on top of the message. And so we have to pay attention to those things, and very often they're not linguistic. They're not expressed literally in words. So you can look at the literal message and get one thing, and then look at the context, and it all changes. And we do that all the time, and we do it very quickly, and we don't pay any attention to it. But when you begin to analyze a conversation, you realize that we're basically paying attention on two levels. We're paying attention on the context level, and we're paying attention on the language level. And we're using the information sort of back and forth to make sense of what's going on. Did you ever, though, get into a conversation where it doesn't make sense? Now, many times if you had a transcript written down of what was said, you can make sense of that. But what the problem is the context is baffling to you. I know people who, well, I think the only thing you could say is they talk all the time. And I had a colleague who's a dear friend of mine, but he would come into this room in mid-sentence. And there's one kind of assumption or class of information that we use in conversations. It's very important linguistically. We call them presuppositions. And so if I say Wes Priebe is Holden's pool hall director, I'm making an assertion about a particular individual, right? In order to make sense of all this, that individual has to exist, right? So we have a very basic presupposition that this person exists, right? Because normally we don't talk about people who don't exist. And if those presuppositions are broken, then we're shoved off into another level, which, you know, fiction operates on. You know, suppose there were a West Preed, then you assert something about it. So that one of the things that happens in conversations is that we're constantly referring to our presuppositions. Well, this fellow who talked all the time would come in mid-sentence talking about people I've never heard of. And so I was thrust constantly in the midst of conversations of his where all the presuppositions were missing. I didn't know who existed, you know, who were assumed to exist in this conversation. So all these people he talked about. And it would take a long time before I would get up to speed with that particular thing. You know, he'd been holding the conversation the next room with other people, but continued it with me. And that kind of shift, you know, you begin to wonder, you know, where am I? What's going on here? I'm just not with it here. And the reason is you've been left out of the beginning of the conversation where the presuppositions are established. Yes.
This happens a lot, I think, with meeting with old friends, for example, because they sort of suppose you know their kids, and you don't think you've never met them.
Yeah.
But they never met mine, and they'll hear about my kid, or somebody else will come into the conversation, like you're saying, and you just, there's all these presuppositions going on.
You know, at the beginning of a conversation, sometimes you have to establish them. You say, well, you know so-and-so, you know, to make sure. Or sometimes, though, you begin right away talking about somebody, assuming the other person knows them or knows who they are. And you might have been, you know, you might be mistaken. And our system of politeness sometimes doesn't allow us to speak up and say, wait a minute, wait, who's so-and-so?
You know?
Yeah.
Somewhere else.
That's right. Okay, so presuppositions are also, besides the existence of things and people, things that have to be true in order to make sense of what is being said. Well, for example, you say, well, I regret turning out the light before I went upstairs. Well, you can't regret something unless you actually did it, right? So it has to be true that I turned out the light, then I went upstairs. Otherwise, it doesn't make much sense to talk about regretting it, right? So those are things that, if you want, are implied by what you're saying, that, you know, the fact that I regret turning out the light before going upstairs implies that I did something. I actually did that. So the presuppositions are always in the background there, and you kind of have to get clear on what they are before you can make sense of what's being said. So context influences our interpretation of all these messages that come out. And what we're doing is we're always computing what the information from the context tells us and then evaluating what the message says. And we try to make sense out of that message according to what context we're in. There are lots of other cues that are part of the context. Intonation we mentioned already. Another thing is the pace of the conversation and turn-taking. Have you ever talked to someone who, in your estimation, talks real slow?
Yeah.
And you just can't wait to get to the end of the sentence, right? If you're, you know, the pace of conversations is one of those context things that varies around different parts of the country. And you... Pardon?
Like a draw.
Well, there are some parts of the country where the pace of a conversation is very leisurely, but, you know, in New York it isn't. They can't even wait for the other person to finish before they're off to the races. Well, if you're talking with someone who has different assumptions about pacing, you know, if yours is quicker than theirs, you just can't wait to jump in there. You can't wait for them to get to the end of their sentence, but you have that other assumption that says you wait for the other person to finish. And so, pacing is one thing. Turn-taking is another. How turn-taking is decided. There are all sorts of little cues that we give that let the other person know it's about your turn. the intonation tells you we're almost to the end here. Whether if it's question, you know, the tone is going up a little bit, and it gets only so high before it's over. And in statements, it turns down at the end, and you know, when it starts to turn down, the sentence is almost over. So we're always looking for those little cues for turn-taking so we can jump in there. Have you ever run into one of those people who don't leave any spots to jump into? You know, end-to-end sentences? Can't get a word in edgewise? This fellow that I talk about who comes in mid-sentence is one of those, you know, and I just tell him, CJ, just stop for a minute. It's the only way you could, you know, sort of flag him down and then, now let me have a turn at it. And he said, oh yes, go ahead. Very polite gentleman from Kentucky, but he didn't.
But 2 seconds later, he's...
Yeah, and then he's off to the races again. Emphasis is another thing that we bring into the whole equation that comes out of the context. You know, you can say a sentence in a very sort of non-committal way, turn out the light, please, right? Or you can change the emphasis, turn out the light, please, not the toaster or whatever. Turn out the light, and we just turned it on again. So there are different things you can emphasize depending on what part of the message it is that you want to highlight. And so there are things from your context, your background assumptions that you wish to get across to the other person and say, this is an important thing. That's what emphasis, accent there. Another variable in conversation is loudness. Of course, the classic one is whispering, right? This message is just for you. The other thing, though, is where you're sitting there with someone and you want to make sure everyone else hears it. Yes, I can come to your house tomorrow. That in itself, you know, betrays an assumption you're making that I'd sure like everybody else to know this. I got invited to so-and-so's house. So, aside from the rules of grammar that tell us how to put the sentences together, we have all these sort of rules, or what you might call conventions, right? A convention is a kind of a rule that a community agrees on. How we do things, and we talk about these as being behavioral conventions. And there's a philosopher named Grice who studied conversations. Philosophers and psychologists are very fascinated by conversation. They study them, and I know a psychologist who does conversational analysis. And, you know, psychologists, they have those one-way mirrors. And they get people having conversations and they run out and they watch them and record them and tape record them, videotape them. But there are some very simple rules that seem to be pretty much universal about conversations and across cultures and in general that we use in, let's say, ordinary, everyday discourse so that things run efficiently. One of the basic ones is, so say as much as necessary and no more. We've already mentioned there are some people who seem to violate that, and we notice it. Say as much as necessary and no more. The sort of rule of efficiency. Another one that really we need in order to make sense out of things is tell the truth, right? Somebody makes an assertion. One of our background assumptions is they're telling the truth. You ever think of any contexts where that is compromised or questioned? Where?
Television.
Unlike
your hands.
Did somebody say politicians?
Yes.
right? We have an ordinary conversation. We have the assumption that no grant the other person, they're telling the truth, right? Until proven otherwise. There are some contexts where...
They say that they think you aren't here.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to talk a little bit about this business of the truth and how we can't always tell the truth. That we end up with the little rules like this that conflict with other rules like don't hurt people. Right? And so we have other strategies for getting around these dilemmas. Another assumption is be relevant. You know, don't talk about Aunt Matilda in Spokane if we don't know about Aunt Matilda in Spokane. There are people who violate this, too. They're talking about all sorts of irrelevant things. The ones who jump from topic to topic, you know, relevant kind of implies keeping on the subject a little bit. And finally, and this is a hard one, be clear. So, if you want a very short list of how to make a nice, clear conversation, this would be a good list, right? Be efficient, say as much as necessary and no more, tell the truth, be relevant, be clear. Great, the ideal conversation. Of course, in practice, that's pretty hard to do. There's something wrong with one of these somewhere along the line. I'd like to take this business of the truth a little bit. Truth is very problematic, you know. Everyone would agree, yes, tell the truth. But there are a number of problems. I think the problem is this. The truth has many dimensions. Everyone wants to be honest, but it's very difficult sometimes to nail down what the truth is. In terms of the message itself, the proposition, a simple thing like Wes Priebe is Holden's pool hall director, it's fairly straightforward. You can understand that's either true or false. You have to find out, does Holden have a pool hall director? Yes. Well, is that person Wes Priebe? Yes. Oh, then it's true. Propositional truth is very straightforward. We put the sentence down on a piece of paper, it's easy to work with. But in the midst of all of the context and the assumptions there, sometimes it gets a little fuzzy. In fact, philosophers have started about 25 years ago discussing something they call fuzzy logic. Ways of handling truth that isn't so nice and black and white. There is, in fact, we can think in terms of the proposition itself, the message, that there are different kinds of truth even there. There's what we call this absolute truth, either true or false. And an assertion has to have one or the other. Or you can put truth a bit on a scale. Well, it's 90% true. And that becomes very useful because when we talk, we use a lot of what we call hedges. A hedge is something that allows us to say something without committing completely to saying it's true. Sort of, kind of, maybe, things like that. Those are well-known hedges. If you look at a sentence like, a whale is a kind of a fish. Now, literally and scientifically, a sentence like, a whale is a fish, isn't true, right? Whales are mammals. Well, boy, they sure do act like fish. And you can say if you go into this business of fuzzy logic or truth on a scale, you can say, well, you know, that's certainly more true than a penguin is a kind of a fish. You know, but look, if you think about it, a penguin does a lot of swimming and so forth, but just whales look more like fish than penguins do. And a penguin is a kind of, it's interesting, a penguin is a kind of a bird. It's somehow less true than a sail, you know, or a seagull is a kind of a bird. You know, so that people understand the differences in truth between these things. Although, in absolute terms, it's not very instructive to talk about sentences like that. So, one of our difficulties with the absolute truth of the message is that we're always hedging our bets, and we're talking vaguely or a little indirectly about what's true and what isn't true.
Does misinformation
come in? Oh, definitely. Propaganda is full of hedges and press statements by politicians, you know. You can find hedges in those galore.
Isn't political correctness almost pushing this truth on a scale to its ultimate?
You mean finding other ways of saying things? And what was that example we had about looting as...
Non-conventional shopping.
Yeah, that those kind of, there used to be a book in the bookstore, and I was looking for it the other day, and it's politically correct bedtime stories. It's things like Rumpelstiltskin and something and so forth, using all of the euphemisms. These are euphemisms, you know. Euphemisms are another way of saying something that isn't loaded. Like you're short can be a way of saying something to somebody that might seem demeaning to them, right? But if you use a euphemism, it seems like it's less harmful, like horizontally challenged, right? Yeah. And we use euphemisms all the time, if nothing else than to say, I don't want to say the word that's loaded. So, and it's kind of a message to them. It's part of the meta message, you know, that I picked this word to be nice to you. It doesn't change the literal sense of the message. You're not quite as tall as other people. But it changes the implications of the message.
How about doublespeak?
Oh, well. Doublespeak is really just a way of making no sense at all while saying something. You know? It's sort of the ultimate hedge. You don't really say, you don't have any message, but you got lots of wrapper. Yes, and you're trying to hide the fact that you don't have anything to say, right? Because after all, if you're a government official, a politician, whatever, if you manage to say a lot without committing to anything, all your options are still open.
Give us an example.
There used to be a list of three columns of doublespeak words, and you could pick any word out of column one, put it with any word in column two, and any word in column three, and come up with an example. Minimizing negative impacts. You know, the sort of bureaucraties that you come up with all the time that has all of these words that you're not quite sure what they mean by that. And that's another way, besides words like maybe and kind of, if you use a word that's vague, right? Vagueness is a very useful concept if you're a bureaucrat or a public official. That way you don't have to spell out in specific terms. I mean, it's just like the word tax cut is vague. You know? It sounds good, but it doesn't spell out in dollars and cents exactly what it is you're going to do. So every politician is for tax cuts, but they don't necessarily spell out what they mean by that.
Where does perspective come in this whole arena of truth telling, not knowing what's free? I was thinking that sentence, what's free is the
pool, right? Well, I picked that example because it was something that all of you may not know, that you may not know this individual. What important is knowing that I was speaking about an individual who could be identified. You know, eventually you'll find out who he is. Yeah.
But in that, my understanding of what a director would be, and perhaps somebody else's understanding of what a director would be. So if I was to say Les Priebe is the pool hall director, someone else might think, that's not true. He's not a very good director. He doesn't do...
He doesn't have an office.
Or he doesn't have his office. Or, you know, I mean, so there's a perspective that you bring to a message, and then people begin to disagree or understand it differently. Because
those perspectives that you're talking about are all those things that belong to context. That whole list of assumptions. And now we're getting in, if you want to talk about specific words like director. Director has a literal meaning. That's its denotation. I mentioned that yesterday. It denotes something, right? In addition to that, there are connotations. That includes your personal impressions of things and personal associations with that word, things that you let's say are evoked in you when you hear that word, like Christmas tree. You know, there's so much more than just, say, some pine on a stand that comes. Yes, exactly. That come with all of that. Those connotations then are part of your context. And what the secret of good communication is trying to match up our context so that we at least know where our context differs from somebody else. We can sort of sort that out and tell that you're understanding this differently than I am. And a lot of conversation gets us into this business of negotiating what it is exactly we mean and what kind of, where are you coming from, you know? Yes, like I said, words and their excess baggage. And everybody's got a different suitcase, you know? Okay, so there are, as I was talking about dimensions of truth, we had the basic truth of the message itself, and even that sometimes is hard to nail down. There are also notions of truth that go beyond the simple language. You know, there's the business of transcendental truth, the truth period, you know, the ultimate truth, the kinds of things that you address, not just in your everyday life, but say in issues of religion and belief. And maybe you will find out in Deanne's class today that, you know, sometimes that even pervades people's context. You know, the Amish, their assumptions, the things they say every day, there is this element of observing transcendental truth, that is, being faithful to a particular set of beliefs that affects your conversation. And so you must really know about that in order to understand where people are coming from. You talk to a Buddhist monk, for example, their discipline and way of life pervades all their conversation. And so you almost have to know what Buddhist monks are like to have a sensible conversation with one. They don't have many conversations with outsiders anyway. So those issues come into play too. And that, those issues of transcendental truth may not always coincide with sort of the ordinary everyday understanding of truth and language and conversation. So that you get to a certain place and all of a sudden a different set of beliefs takes over and you're in a different context altogether because you've struck on some particular religious area. It may have to do with, you know, belief of afterlife or reincarnation or... Well, there's maybe a good example. If you read Doonesbury, there's this character, Boopsy, who's a channeler, right? And all of a sudden, she's talking as if she's some 13th century warrior or something like that. And, you know, that's the kind of shift you can suddenly get when these background beliefs, like religious ones, suddenly come in and take over the conversation. It's very interesting. Perhaps some of that will come out in the religious communities. You have a different set of beliefs if you're talking to let's say a monk, than you would if you're just talking to a neighbor over coffee. Another dimension of truth is what we might call the scientific truth or empirical truth. The whale as a mammal is a good example. You know, ultimately, behind most statements about facts in the world, there is some kind of scientific truth. But if you're not worried about that. Conversational truth about the discussion of whale is a mammal or whale's kind of a fish. You can have a debate over that. Quite independently of the scientific facts. You know, so the question becomes, which truth is it that you're referring to here in this conversation? Some transcendental truth, the scientific truth, just the simple linguistic or logical truth. There are many dimensions of truth, and people operate in different dimensions at different times, and that's the problem. You know, are we having a scientific discussion, just a linguistic debate, you know, working on our own knowledge and not necessarily what the scientists will tell us about that? Or are we having a debate over superstition, which, again, shifts the entire background assumptions and what ends up being true or false? So that's one of the problems with being honest. Which truth or which dimension of truth are we in right now? And that's where your beliefs come in, because you carry with you all the time certain beliefs, and you're always testing your beliefs. You know, what is going on here? What is the goal of this conversation, and what are the background assumptions out of the many that we could have that are active right now? And they change, you know, from minute to minute, depending on who's in the conversation. You have different assumptions if you're talking to an old friend than if you're talking to a perfect stranger who's, let's say, dressed up in Amish garb, right? Immediately you talk to someone like that, all of your assumptions change. In fact, many times when you meet someone new who you know is, say, from another culture or something, you realize all of my background assumptions are out the window, and I'm hanging out here with no life raft. I don't know where to begin. We feel safest when we are more sure of what the background assumptions are, when we are confident of our beliefs about what's going on here in this conversation. Now, besides those things, which are about sort of ideal conversations, then we have a number of pragmatic assumptions about how we carry on discussions. These are often called the cooperative principles. You know, the way that we actually have decent conversations, what's going on here? They're kind of rules of behavior, do's and don'ts for having a good conversation. And here's where this business of involvement and independence comes in. I mentioned that at the end last time. Did you get a chance to think about that? Did anybody run across any examples where they were negotiating or balancing involvement versus independence in a discussion? When I think about it, I think, you know, particularly in families, that's what's happening, you know, that, right? Many times what we're doing is we're negotiating who's going to do what. And the issue is, who is going to be the one whose particular point of view ends up prevailing? Are you going to tell me what to do, or am I going to tell you what to do? You know, and whose involvement is going to get the upper hand, and who's going to keep their independence?
We have a nephew who spent a couple summers with us, and I found myself saying, would you like to take out the trash? And he said, Aunt Jackie, I would rather you say, Paul, take out the trash, than would you like to take out the trash? Because he said, the answer is no. Or would you like to move along? He said, to be honest, I'd have to say no. So I would rather that you just give me a command and say,
well,
please take out the trash. I expect you to mow the lawn.
Because he
that
was a nephew, because he was a nephew, you thought you had to be more indirect with him, right?
But he pointed out that this was one of the problems his mother had, my younger sister, because she'd be polite like that to the kids, and they would rather that she just be direct and give her expectations and not give them the choice, because she didn't really want them to have a choice. She wanted them to do it. She wasn't quite being honest, and neither was I. And he was saying he'd rather I be honest than saying this is what I expect of you, than couch it in kind of like terms that I like I was talking
about. Yeah. We're going to get into the uses of indirectness in just a minute, and it has to do with the business of telling the truth, you know. Yes.
I think I have an example of this involvement versus independence. I have a very good friend who is a pastor's wife, and they were living in an apartment. They had five children, and after a few years, she felt they needed new carpeting in their home, which, of course, is a financial outlay of money. And her husband felt that the carpeting was still okay. And I think she started out very calmly by saying, wouldn't it be nice to have a new carpeting? Didn't get any response from that. Next time, I think her little more emphasis said, we really need new carpeting. Still no response. And then I think she directly asked, you know, right. May we have it?
That forces involvement. Direct question.
Finally, in desperation one day, as sweetly as she could, she said, honey, you may get carpeting willingly or unwillingly, but we're going to do carpeting. We have a choice.
It's my attitude.
There's a very interesting parallel happened in our own parish this spring where the parsonage really needed carpeting, but of course it was the church property committee's job, right? And the pastor's wife told the pastor, you know, we really need to do something about the carpet. And he said, oh, I couldn't ask the council for new carpeting at this point. And so she concluded that, well, I could. So she got the wife of the council president. Talk about, you know, indirectness, and it worked. I mean, she made sure there was carpeting in that parsonage. But there, you know, people like the pastor there had to maintain his independence from this issue. And so there had to be another route and another way of phrasing it, if you wish. How about it, coffee drinkers? Are your tongues hanging out at this point? We've gone over 40 minutes. Shall we? What would you like to do? Would you like to just barge right on and maybe finish 10 minutes early?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. Then let's keep going. I was just about to talk about cooperative principles, and here there are sort of three short rules for this balancing of independence and involvement. If you don't impose, keep your distance, right? That's independence there, right? Give options. Let the other person have a say. And be friendly. Maintain rapport. And rapport is a good word for involvement, right? You want to create rapport because that's good involvement. There's also bad involvement, right? That's in the depths of a nasty argument. That's real involved, but it's not very pleasant. So, whereas the other set of rules I was talking about, the sort of rules of conversation, were how to be efficient at conversation, this is sort of how to achieve your goals and to get your payoffs, rapport, without sort of lying down and let the other person roll over you, too. So, those little rules are directed at some other aims of conversation that, again, don't come out of the language side, but come out of the social side of how we interact. And of course, one of them we've already mentioned is politeness. Politeness, of course, is culturally specific. We have certain norms of politeness. Other people in other parts of the country or in other cultures have different norms of politeness. And of course, the other one is basically a moral issue. You know, just how honest are we going to be? Brutally honest, always honest, Boy Scout honest. You know, that is a moral issue. Yeah, it's a moral issue, and it's also not a simple, straightforward one. It's like, you know, tax cuts. Everyone's in favor of honesty. But as I said, there are so many dimensions of the truth. How do you know for sure when you're being honest? These rules, though, help us to negotiate, if you want, some kind of mutual understanding, right? If we're polite on both sides of the conversation to the sort of level that we're used to, then we have a way at least of going back and forth. It gives the other person room to negotiate and come back and say, you know, say if necessary, well, what do you mean by that? You know, if something is put politely, you can politely question. But sometimes questioning something is not polite. Well, what's that supposed to mean? Boy, can you signal your context, you know, by the intonation and the way you phrase things. You know, that is much less a question than it is a statement.
I
think in the clearest case of that sort of thing is, I think I understand what you're saying by that, and I don't like it. And I'll give you one last chance to fix it. It's interesting that in this book, that's not what I meant. And I think that title, you know, sort of gives you an idea of the kind of thing. She talks about cases of spiraling misunderstanding, where you have exchanges which are just like that. You know, what's that supposed to mean, right? How is that answered? How, you know, think in your own experience when someone says something, sort of an aggressive rejoinder like that. How is that usually answered? Is it usually answered with a calm explanation of what it actually meant? It's usually answered again with another assertion. You know, that means reinterpret the first thing a little bit, but I'll throw in a few more things. These become what they call kitchen sink arguments. You know, that you start throwing everything into the argument, and so that creates another misunderstanding in that, oh, I thought we were talking about the first subject, now we're talking about subject number two. Well, then I can play this game too. Here comes subject number three. And pretty soon, you've got all the old baggage on the table, and it's a free-for-all. That's what they mean by spiraling misunderstanding. And these are the kinds of sort of traps you can be caught in, given certain contexts on both sides. You know, it's like catching two platoons at the front facing each other with lots of ammunition. What are they going to do? Well, they're going to start using up their ammunition. Okay. I think we've arrived at a point here where you can see that a very important part of the context in conversation is attitude. Your attitudes and your intentions. That's part of your beliefs. You know, what's going on here? What am I trying to achieve? And what is my assessment of the person I'm talking to and how they fit into that, right? Think of visits you might have had from salesmen, the kind that come knocking on the door at about dinner time. You're not entirely sure whether the enterprise is on the up and up and that sort of thing. But have you ever run into the kind with a real attitude? That's their style. They have set their assumptions a certain way, that to be efficient, I'm going to do the hard sell. If it's going to work, you know, these people are just going to crumple, I'll make the sale and be off. If it's not going to work, they'll slam the door. This is efficient. It works, right? Isn't it annoying, though? Well, we go to the door, we have a different set of assumptions. Right, there's going to be a person there, and they're going to observe certain levels of politeness. And that's what you expect when you open the door, and when you get this sort of in-your-face sales pitch, it's very jarring. I know it really steams me, and I've sent many of them packing, and don't come back.
I think we wish we were all thinking of vacuum cleaners.
Yes. Well, in my case, it's been encyclopedia salesmen and frozen food salesmen. You know, those sort of deals, you know.
Cleaning supply sales.
More often than like telephone salesmen instead of a knock on the door.
Yeah. We think of the attitudes, these specific sort of attitudes. Now we're talking internally here of your sort of psychological state as a frame. The frame, then, is the, if you want, the mixture of these sort of context things, which are actually external variables, you know, who am I, who's the person I'm talking to. Now we've added the other thing, you know, what's my mood, what am I trying to achieve here, what are my intentions, all these internal psychological things. Together with the context, that's the frame. Now, the interesting thing about frames is that we can shift them. We shift our frames. We are fickle creatures, right? We, for example, we're going along in a conversation and the other person opens up a new opportunity and says, well, you know, I can't promise that I'll watch your kids on the weekend, but I tell you what, suppose we get my cousin to come and babysit for all of our kids, you know. So this shifts the frame. Now you're not no longer trying to get something out of the person, you know, a couple hours of babysitting, but you're negotiating an entirely new thing, and your internal state, your attitude towards this has changed. I'm no longer going to badger my neighbor here, but we're going to now, we're working cooperatively on a new plan that's going to get the problem solved. And so frame shifting becomes one of the sort of things that's the important aspect of negotiation. And a lot of what we do when we have conversations is negotiate. We don't have to sit down at a table there and have a lawyer on each side to have a negotiation. We do that all the time, particularly within families, right? Negotiating who's going to go plug in the coffee in the morning and bring it to me in bed. You may have had that negotiation years ago, and that's sort of settled, and there's a context assumption. And then when the other person suddenly gets up and brings the coffee, and why, that's unexpected, you know. But those kinds of issues are constantly being negotiated in groups. If you look at the community here and how things have to work, there has to be a lot of negotiation. Every week they have a staff meeting, where all kinds of new tasks are brought up. It's negotiated who's going to do what. They have certain things, you know, like rough, heavy work is done by the Mavericks, those guys who wear those work gloves all the time and go around lifting heavy things. But then there may be a complex task that requires a cooperative effort. You have to negotiate whose role is which, who's going to do what, and so forth. So a lot of frame shifting comes in the context of negotiation. And the thing about frames is you know the context. You may be certain of what is going on here in terms of, for example, right now we're having a sort of a class-type setting, and there's one guy in the front running off at the mouth, and then occasionally someone will contribute something from the other group, and you know how that's supposed to work. But what you don't know are the internal variables, the mood of everyone else, what they're trying to get out of it, and so forth, what their part of the frame is. And so it can happen that the frame can be shifted abruptly. I've had it happen in classes and universities where, I don't know, when there's some particular issue going on, someone will come get up in class and say, I'm from the student society, and we're going to discuss the new tuition increases. You know, there's a big frame shift for you. And you find out, of course, that this is all, that, you know, this is one of those things ticking away in the internal part of the the frame for students that they're ready to talk about that, and we might as well throw about half of my lecture notes out the window because that's what they're going to do. The student society is called today to discuss tuition increases in all the classes. Well, that, yeah. There's a frame shift I had no control over. It was the other side that decided to shift the frame. So frame shifts can be beneficial to the conversation. They can also be disruptive. You know, they can shift to a point where you more closely coincide, as when, you know, you're trying to negotiate babysitting time and then you find the third solution that solves it for everybody. That's what compromise is. So these shifts are constant. We're always moving them around, and sometimes the problem is we don't notice it. The frame is shifted and we don't notice it. You ever feel like the train is left and you're not on it in a conversation? Where you might be sitting around talking with five or six people and there's a new direction and everybody has new intentions with the conversation. They instead of saying, what should we have for supper tonight, they're all of a sudden talking about restaurants. They want to go out. And you're still thinking about whether you should have rice or potatoes. You didn't get with the frame shift, you know? Yeah, you didn't know when you were taking me out to dinner. There's a frame shift for you. Another part of the frame, too, is what we call the footing. And that's... It's the combination of the context and your interpretation of it, and in particular the individuals involved. You're having a conversation with someone. You are on a social footing with them. So you have attitudes about that. We have many cases of footing where there's someone with a higher level of authority and someone with a lower level of authority, right? You might have a perfectly good, polite conversation with, say, President Clinton. Suppose you're invited to the White House for a one-on-one, half an hour with the president. You could have a nice conversation. You'd find things to talk about, right? A very similar sort of footing is, let's say, convict and his warden, right? But you can imagine the attitudes might be quite different, you know? As a citizen, you could go into the White House with this idea of curiosity and making sure the president got a piece of your mind on tax policy and a few other things. But you can imagine that a particularly difficult prisoner brought in to have a, you know, 30 minutes in the woodshed with the warden has a different attitude altogether. Defensive, you know, I'm not going to let that warden know some things that I'm thinking, but then there are others I'm going to really let him know, and so forth, and resentment, all these other attitudes that come out. So one of the things that we notice in conversations is where someone does a frame shift that, in a sense, breaks the sort of rules of footing for two people. Story of, say, a parking lot attendant. And the movie star comes in with the Rolls Royce, hands the keys to the parking lot attendant, gives them a long list of, you know, I don't want you to park it way out here where, you know, people might sneak into the lot and do something to it, and I don't want you to park it over there where it's right on a corner and someone might come around the corner and bang into it and all this stuff. And the fed-up parking lot attendant flips the keys back and says, park it yourself. Right? That's a shift of footing, right? Parking lot attendant's supposed to do what he's told and park the car. And that's the sort of thing that happens where the social context is, let's say, broken, and there's a change of footing all of a sudden. Or there are those surprise changes of footing where you're talking with some ordinary guy and then all of a sudden you discover it's really some senator you didn't recognize, right? And you have rules that say, well, I'd talk this way to some guy in a coffee shop, but I'd talk differently if I knew it were a senator, you know? So footing is something we're always conscious of, and we're most comfortable in ordinary everyday circumstances where we're on equal footing, right? We don't have to worry about who's on top. But many places, like work, we're not always on equal footing. There's the boss, and there are the people who might work for you, and you have to keep aware of all this stuff. There's a very interesting study someone did, a PhD thesis studying conversations in churches, and in particular pastor talk. Pastors have a real problem with footing, because they have to lead on the one hand without appearing to on the other. And this can lead to, and now we're going to get into this thing that we mentioned, and we're almost done today, and I'm going to bring it up here. They are big time users of indirectness. Right? I've seen these long dialogues have been recorded and transcribed and analyzed, that congregational meeting, and the pastor wants to get some new signs on the outside of the church. Simple thing, you'd think, right? Congregational meetings have these long, involved discussions. And they, many times, if you look at them, they come out of the pastor's need to have the congregation do something that costs money without actually coming out and saying, would you mind buying some signs and sticking them up on the side of the church? They talk, they sort of back into it about the need for people to be able to see where to go around the church. And if you looked at the transcript, you'd see it looks like a guessing game. You know, church council, please guess what I'm thinking. And it's because they feel they can't say this directly. We need some signs on the outside of the church. Well, that's true, you know. And this person who did this analysis also then interviewed people in the congregation, and they said, yes, that's the way pastors ought to behave. That's what they expect. So pastors are only behaving the way they're expected to. And this, it's a classic example of indirectness. And we use indirectness based on all these things we've talked about so far, and in the context, our internal attitudes, the footing we're in, and so forth. And we use indirectness sometimes even to avoid being honest.
Sure, being inefficient.
Yes, we are being inefficient, because we have to assess the situation and decide, what's the most important thing about this conversation? Being efficient or observing our rules of politeness and expectations about my role, that is the footing, and everything else? What you're trying to do is get something done without doing it directly, or getting an answer without doing it directly, or saying something about a direct question. This is maybe the hardest one, without directly answering it, because you feel that the answer may hurt someone. You know, that's one reason we're dishonest. Sometimes we can't be honest about things, even if, you know, our politeness rule says you can't be honest here. So we get indirect. Yeah.
There's another part of that, though, is that it's about the involvement, mm-hmm. Versus being kind
of independent.
Right, versus independent. I mean, a pastor may see a need, but until everybody sees that need and understands the complexity of that need, then, autocratically saying this is what we're going to do does not involve people. It's got to be a shared kind of a vision in order for everybody to sort of be.
That's right.
So it's really leadership.
It is, but but what I'm saying is there are different rules for pastors than, say, the church treasurer, right? I've been a church treasurer, and what they do is they say, well, can we afford it? No? Okay, that's the end of it. You know? Different. Treasurers can be direct. Pastors can't.
There's a should part. Should they be dangerous?
Yeah. But there is an expectation that we'll get the straight answer from the treasurer, right? And if the answer is no, then they really want something, they'll come around and say, well, how could we come to afford it? You know.
But the treasurer has a context too.
That's right. The treasurer has a context. I've got the facts and figures. You know.
For now.
Yes. Yes.
Wow, the clergy is the subject. The worship service, say, is expected to be from 11 to 12. So the pastor knows that he or she has, say, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, say, some fixed period of time, say, 20 minutes. Now, and then the pastor decides what message they want to give.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if they can say it in 3 minutes, it's going to take 20.
Actually, I have seen pastors who do a 5-minute sermon, you know, and everyone sits and looks around at each other like, we didn't get our money's worth this morning.
Well, where can I find that church?
That was a campus church in the late 60s, and I think it was the attention.